Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I trust you have had an interesting and intellectually stimulating week, and you are ready for the serious discussion that will definitely stand the test of time that we are going to have this evening on all matter of malarkey. So cheers, everybody. Cheers, resident poet. Cheers, Tommy M. Cheers, Sensible Centre. Cheers, Lipton. Cheers,
Scrubianan.
Helgen Gerligan. Cheers, Mark. Helgen Gerligan.
Yakidar.
Yes.
Nazrovia.
Saludo. Frust. Prost. Yes. And Slanger and Slangervar and Skoll and Proust. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, on the Public House. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time. 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based stuff that is in the news and research that is expunged from our woke joke university. So, hello, Fresh Toast. Cheers to you, sir, and Skoll and all that. And we have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Mark Houghton. Mark, say hello.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. I'll just introduce you. So Mark is the founder of the old
Minimalist Society.
The Minimalist and the old Basket Weavers. And so you may have heard of that. Also, news, chaps, news. Not only did I buy a new car today, specifically a Kia something or other, hybrid something.
God, no, Ed, no.
Also it means
the apostrophe D.
No, Ed.
Petrol.
Hybrid.
You save petrol.
You're saving the planet, you deviant.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. But it was a Kia, I forget what make of
she
Kia.
She got an inefficient diesel, like a good self-respecting person.
There was in the, they're very interesting places, car showrooms. They're very massive things full of cars, very manly places, car showrooms. It has a lot of testosterone in car showrooms. And there was an unbelievably cheap car with not much mileage on the clock, which was, I don't know what it was going for, like $8,000 or something. And I thought, well, what on earth, how could it be so cheap? Diesel. So straight away I knew. But anyway, look, chaps, look what's been published today.
Hey.
Here it is. This book is so hot and so incendiary, I can't touch it for that long. But it's the Quaker question, exposing the sect that really rules the world. So you can get the ebook on the old Amazon, and you can get the published book from Wild Things. Yes.
Why is that book published so quickly?
It's not. I'm working on it for ages.
Because yeah, there are no very few words typed inside at Lipton.
Not the duration of the writing, but I assume that it was difficult to get it published. I didn't know you had that published already.
How many bowls of porridge can you take photos of for a book? Come on.
It was extremely difficult to get it published. It was rejected by all the usual people, either because it wasn't anti-Semitic enough or it was too anti-Semitic. You just couldn't get the balance right.
Goldilocks.
Exactly like Goldilocks, which also, of course, as we all know on here, doesn't conform to the basic rules of thermodynamics. How can the biggest get the cold? Anyway, look, it's all the point.
You're pitching a book of an academic nature to your audience, so I have to ask on their behalf, is it illustrated and are there pictures so they can follow along?
That is the most egregious
Mark, comment. Mark, Ed normally, Ed specialises in the pop-up variety.
On the Jolly Heretic audience, as we know, the Jolly Heretic audience are a highly intellectual bunch who are very much like reading. But it's not that long. It's
potato only painting.
162 pages long.
Well, that's what you say. A company said that they will consider my book. So I sent them an email. I sent them a picture a long time ago, and they finally responded, and they said they will consider it for publication.
Blankets I have known.
The audience is asking two things. Does it come in big fonts so they can read it? And secondly, can we colour in the Quaker? Colour by numbers.
You can. There is a Quaker in the middle if you get that far. You have to get that far that you can colour in.
To stimulate the mind halfway through.
Yeah, it's a very intellectually stimulating book. Okay, so go out and buy it now, chaps. It's available from the publisher, which is Wild Things, who of course are involved in the old conferences and all that, and the Wittad and so on. And it's available from Amazon KDP. Get on with things. Good. So this is anyway. This is Mark.
When can I download it online for free?
I've discovered that a little fault in Amazon KDP that allows people like you to steal books. Literally.
Yeah,
and why don't you include with every copy one of those bowel cancer tests that you get in the post? beyond a certain age, because that would suit your demographic.
Is that just something very specific to you?
Look, we're not going to get into this. Simply you need to go out there and buy the new book, and that's that. Okay, good. We'll lower the price. Fine. Okay, good. So this is Mark, anyway, and Mark established the Basket Weavers in 2022, as I recall it was. In fact, it was about now in 2022 that I remember doing, when we'd been stuck in Finland for years because of the coup, that I did a little advertising video for the Basket Weavers. I remember doing that. And then came to London and did a speech in March 2022. So 3 years ago. Four years ago. Bloody hell, 4 years ago, Christ. There we go. Doesn't time pass when you're doing based stuff? So, Paul, I think we shall start off then with the extent. I was amazed by some of the stuff that's been going on this week. The incompetence of these people. First of all, they're cancelling elections in East Sussex and West Sussex and Norfolk and Suffolk and all over the place. And now they've just said they can't do that, and they were lying and they were wrong. They were absolutely certain, absolutely adamant to cancel elections, and they were lying and they were wrong. And now the thing that you highlighted to me, which I thought was very interesting, was this idea that the extent, the effort they go into to cover up the grooming gang thing. So what was it, Paul, that stimulated you about the job?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll put into some context for people who haven't seen it. But I think it was Times Radio, John Pienaar interviewed Lord Glasman, and it's on the thumbnail. And I advise everyone, as many as possible, to have a watch of it. It's only about 15 minutes. But basically, I'd slightly disagree with you, Ed. I don't think it was deliberately covering it up. I actually think John Pienaar, who I didn't really have any animus against until I saw this interview, I think he just epitomised the narcissism and self-centeredness of the media class, because he wasn't capable of actually, well, it was worse than that. He wasn't initially capable of recognizing the points Glasman was making towards him. He would say, yeah, I'm not disputing or diminishing anything, quickly move on and ignore the point that was made. But on the specific point of grooming gangs, I had to go back and listen to it again, because John Pienaar actually said the grooming gangs in the bigger picture of immigration were a very, very, very small detail. He repeated it three times. And my point would be, if anyone from a different race, if a white person had said that about any other race, they'd be in court on hate crime charges. To say that the potential assault of, Glasman reckoned 50,000, who knows? The fact we don't know for sure is another factor. But for not to know to within the nearest 10,000 and to call that a very small detail, I just think it shows just an inability to even begin. I honestly don't think he did it deliberately or with subterfuge. I think he is that glass-eared, but I don't know what you think.
To clarify around the numbers involved when it comes to the grooming gang cases, there's still some live streams on my channel, Not So Obvious, which is relatively, it's not inactive, but like I only produce something about once a month on it now. But I did a series of streams called Atrocity Project. At the time, I naively believed I could do more for the grooming gangs than I could, it turns out. But the conservative estimate is about 350,000 affected. So the issue with the grooming, and the top end is a million, but that was the million figure, which is often parroted, comes specifically from the Labour councillor. I can't remember her name exactly off the top of my head, which is driving me nuts because she was very famous, and she was let go from the Labour Party, I believe, for making that statement that it was a million girls and was freaking out about it. But the estimate I came to was around 350,000. Obviously, it's still ongoing. This is a thing with this particular case. The grooming gang case is curious because politically, it's treated as if it's a historical artifact. It's a bit like, I don't know, talking about the Holocaust or something like that, right? Where it's something that happened, it's something that's horrible, but we're kind of past that now. We're moving on. Isn't it horrible? There's a kind of the old statement, which is that 10 deaths is a tragedy and a million deaths is a statistic. So the it's a similar issue, and I think there's something similar when you look at something like the Epstein files, where just the sheer scale of it, right, is almost impossible to comprehend. And you know, they've only done a data drop on Epstein files. That's a small sum of what it is, and that's already millions and millions of files. Now, obviously, people coming through that's irrelevant. To come back to the grooming gangs, we have this thing where we have up to, Sarah Champion, that's the one. Thank you so much, chat.
She was an MP, not a council, an MP.
And, yes, and the issue is that, yeah, so one is this refusal to acknowledge that it's still ongoing, because if it's still ongoing, then they have a duty to act. And because the Pakistanis are one of their client groups for the political establishment, and they're obsessed, obviously, with the liberal order, and I don't want to be seen to be giving group judgments on anything which isn't the majority, that needs to be pushed to the side, right? Pushed to the side, which is why, again, they stopped collecting data on it. So you'll look at a lot of this data, and it ends with the J report. And it ends in sort of early 2010s, and not much has been talked about afterwards, and even the police raids and things stopped, right? Because, again, they did the report, this is horrible, and then it was treated like a historical case rather than an ongoing problem that needs to be continually dealt with. So I don't... There's a kind of strange inertia with the whole thing. And you can see this with Rupert Lowe's rape gang inquiry, which they've patently ignored. No mainstream media company has covered it. No political discussions really have been taking place. I will see whether or not Rupert obviously pushes it. And I'll just finish my little ramble here off by saying that that's the most curious thing of all. I think they're just unwilling to deal with the scale of it, unwilling to prosecute or criminalize the people who are taking part in it because of the nature of their identity, and they're kind of pushing the boat on, right? They just push it on. The next government will deal with that if they want to, and that's that.
Also, the girls that have been subjected to this have mostly, although not exclusively, but have mostly been working class, and I can't help but thinking that that's relevant to why they don't really care, because it's not people like them. It's this people that they used to
there's definitely a not people index, essentially, which is what the issue was at the beginning. So we saw the classification of the victims as child prostitutes first. Working class English culture is a really curious one, especially the sort of the chav effect, right, where you've got deeply antisocial teenagers who are known to the authorities already, and then have come from broken homes or whatever. You know, there ends up being a sort of antisocial working class culture in there, which makes them very hostile to social services and police anyway. And then social services and police don't do anything because they falsely characterize these girls as prostitutes and refuse to prosecute the people who are perpetrating the crimes. And those people, and they don't want to be seen as racist. And then, so that causes even further community disengagement. And then suddenly that resentment of authority, which is already present in the working classes, has like real tangible reasons to be, I mean, aside from the other reasons that I'm sure they have historically before this, but they have real tangible reasons to distrust authority and to be antisocial anyway. And to say, well, if you're not going to enforce the law over this horrible abuse and rape of our community, then why should we obey any laws at all, right? So you end up with this kind of sort of meshing of perspectives where you can understand why they reject almost all of society.
But Mark, can I ask specifically, my point was about the media elite, because am I being too literal-minded to think that John Pienaar, as a journalist, might be able to understand basic journalism and be aware of the scale of the problem and perhaps be sensitive to accusations of making, at very best, a monumentally insensitive and crass comment? And my rhetorical response to this would be, a white person could not have said what he said. They just couldn't. And also, I just think, it's on a completely different point. Beth Rigby still present Sky News after the scandal when she was found guilty of exactly what she accused the politicians of. Alistair Campbell still makes a fortune on podcasts, being up to his neck with Mandelson. There is no accountability whatsoever for the media class who can't even do their own journalistic jobs.
No. There's sort of three things to pull out here. The first is, one, most journalists are incredibly ignorant. The news cycle, aside from anything else, the news cycle has accelerated now to the point where, like, we talk about people's attention spans in general decreasing. The attention span of the average journalist is probably about half that. So, again, this lack of comprehension, as you say, he gets the numbers completely wrong. He's not done any personal digging into this. He probably associates the whole thing with Tommy Robinson as well, which the entire media class has been allied against sort of for the last 20 years. So there's that going on. So there's this kind of, if you consider it the default media position, which is, one, Tommy Robinson bad, two, grooming gangs is kind of his thing. Therefore, it must be sort of, there's something wrong with even questioning that. Isn't it racist? And then thirdly is like, you just don't understand or comprehend the scale of the thing. And this is also the problem which I think Restorer's run into with the grooming gang inquiry, and why it's had no cut through in the media as well, really, is because their entire publication of it is not really offender-centric. If the rape gang inquiry had produced a list of prominent, current, sitting Labour councillors, for instance, who were all tied up in this, and their families, and their extended families, then maybe something could be done. But
was that case, wasn't there, in the last week, of some female, in her own right, mayor, who was Bangladeshi or something like this, and who covered up for her son, who was involved in...
Yeah. So she was a former mayor. She had served out a one-year term as mayor, and then her son had been caught having filmed some horrendous thing that he had done. I think it was a sexual assault or a rape. And then the police had come to the door, and she had yelled at him in Urdu to go and get his phone and destroy the evidence, basically, whilst blocking them from coming in the building. Not quite necessarily connected to the same thing, but obviously it's similar. But my point being with the rape gang inquiry is they've put the victims' testimonies first and foremost, which are horrific, but as someone who's read almost every grooming gang report, which is sickening reading, it's a bit torture porn, to be honest. It's like you're reading this, oh, isn't this horrible? Isn't this horrible? Isn't this horrible? They're all named Muhammad, which makes them a kind of faceless mass as well, where you go, right, okay. Well, we exist in a society right now where no one, particularly in the media class or the political class, is willing to engage in this, in a kind of group-based discrimination against the majority, right? So you couldn't tar all Pakistanis with the same brush, according to the current media consensus, because that goes against liberalism, it goes against individualism and everything like that. And instead, what you have is, as you say, the faceless mass. Like, who's accountable? Like, they tried to say, well, is Labour councillors accountable? Well, what are their names? When I was looking at this, I was like, where's the police commissioner? What's he doing now? I want to know all the names of all the people all the way down the tree, and then assess their culpability and so on. But that is like a 10, 15-year project, maybe. Like, that, it's a huge number of people and everything else, which is why, again, the sort of remigration sentiment, which also focuses on the grooming gangs, is like, yeah, just get them all out, you know, or make things so hostile for them that they choose to leave. And we just don't care. We just won't endure this anymore. Because the idea of actually having to put in the work on a granular level to identify exactly who was guilty and who was not, especially with a lot of historic cases, is just mind-boggling, if not impossible, right? So,
Lipton, you haven't said anything.
Okay, then. There is an interesting parallel, you know, journalists behave everywhere and not just in the typically rich Western country like the UK or the US. Some years ago, the knockout game was quite popular, right? That man who passed, Colin Flaherty, he wrote quite extensively on the knockout game. The media journalists were not interested in covering the knockout game. Then during the pandemic, there was the anti Asian crimes, journalists were not interested in committing those crimes. And now in London, well, not now, but for some time in London, we have been having a number of crimes. And I was online recently and somebody was complaining to a presenter online and the presenter said, deal with it. Now, that man was attacked twice in London.
Oh, deal with being stabbed, wasn't it?
Yes.
That will happen in an artist. You'll get stabbed. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah,
exactly. So, what, Mark, you made an important point. I don't know if journalists, if they're just stupid or disingenuous. I can't tell anymore.
It's both.
Well, I'd say no. Sorry, I'd say it's neither. I think it's much more. It's a shame Richard is not, but it's much more to do with narcissism. At one point in this specific interview, Pienaar says, "I am offended by what was his name, Ratcliffe's comments. I am offended," as if that was the beginning and end of the discussion. How about people being offended, John Pienaar, by everything that's gone on in the grooming gangs? How about that being offensive? But no one challenges the fact him saying, "I am offended," is the measurement of how serious an issue is. And he's supposed to be a bloody journalist. He's supposed to be relatively neutral.
Said it, this Manchester United chap's remarks are both offensive and wrong. Well, if they're wrong, they're wrong, right? So they're wrong, so that's the end of the matter. But it's not good enough that they're wrong. They're offensive as well. And that's worse. That's in many ways worse than them being wrong. They're offensive.
It's the prefix theory, which I enjoy, which is that anytime you add a prefix to something, it perverts the original purity of the meaning of the thing. So, for instance, you've got justice and you've got social justice. And therefore, social justice can never actually be just because, you've added this prefix. And in a similar way, it's like the offense prefix to everything. In the same, attempted murder, but, was there a racial intent behind it or something like that, right? Like, so they come down harder on you if, let's say, you had a racist motive, for instance, for attacking someone versus if you just were drunk and attacked someone or... if you just had an off day and attacked someone and you had a falling down moment, right? So it doesn't matter, that we've disconnected. The only place I can see where that intent really matters is the difference between manslaughter and murder, right? Like there's a difference between premeditated murder and manslaughter, although not that much, to be honest. If you decide in the moment that you're going to, in a fight with someone, you're going to kill them, that's different to accidentally killing someone. So I think there's some nuance there, but I do not think it's like if you rob someone's house, right? You want that for financial gain or whatever. If you rob a black man's house, Ed, and you've robbed Lipton's house, and suddenly he can get you on a racial attempt and get 3 years added to your sentence because we don't deal with that racially aggravated nonsense here, right?
Exactly. And look how luxurious his house is. So there's every reason to rob Lipton's house. I mean, he's got the grand piano over there. It's like the house of him out of Grand Theft Auto 5, isn't it?
I do want to come back to Paul's point about the media class and its narcissism. Definitely true. That I will draw an allegory between this and... of all things, the gaming journalists of Gamergate, which is not something which would regularly come up, but it came to light that gaming journalists, aside from the whole Gamergate thing, it came to light that they were asking companies for kickbacks in order to do journalism, right, basically. So they put themselves, if you want us to review your game, you're going to give us a nice flight over and we'll do a demo in your location and you'll give us a nice dinner, a nice hotel and so on. And gaming companies were paying for them because there were a revenue stream. But of course, when everyone realized that whatever the likes of IGN and so on were a nonsense because they were essentially paying the journalists to write puff pieces about them, and those journalists had a very inflated sense of self. Now, obviously, that industry has been completely destroyed because there's an entire now video economy of reviewers and so on. But this is one of the things which disaggregates the regular media, the mainstream, from, say, alternate media, yourself, Ed, or something like that, right? So where your accountability is to your audience, right? Whereas the pundits that you're mentioning there, Paul, his accountability is to his editor, possibly. And then if not his editor, that editor is accountable to you know, whoever's running the company and their broader overarching goals, and they're beholden to political interests themselves. So you end up in a situation where if I mention the grooming gangs, right, it might be conscious, it might be subconscious. If I mention the grooming gangs and I come down hard and I start accusing people, not only might I lose my job because I'm considered to be associated with the bad man, Tommy Robinson, or secondly, I may, like narcissistically speaking, I may lose a whole bunch of my contacts in Westminster or further afield or in whatever sector that I'm interested in. Again, I don't think any of this is conscious, right? And so then what's the psychological defense mechanism to something this huge that, if true, would render your entire commentary and existence kind of meaningless? It represents as narcissism, right? It goes, I'm not going to talk about this. This isn't something worth talking about. I'm not interested in that. You know, aren't you just a racist? You know, you suddenly get into the projection sphere because they're scared of this topic, whether they admit it or not. And if they're not scared of it, then they're in the idiocy camp, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but I think Ed, did you see the bit? Did you watch the whole thing? Didn't you?
Yes.
Did you? What I also found interesting, because I'm not disagreeing with what Mark's saying at all, but I do think there's a generic point that goes beyond any specific topic. So they mentioned at the end of the interview, Glassman was saying the Navy should go in and stop boat people coming into the country. And Pienaar couldn't understand how this could happen. He said, how would this work? He said, would it involve force? So the idea that the Royal Navy might actually use force for what it's designed to do.
He was incomprehending about what you would force them. You would force them.
Well, that was one part. So he didn't understand that a Royal Navy is actually a military unit. He also didn't understand. He said, the French wouldn't let you. The idea that you might do something that the godforsaken French wouldn't like you to do is beyond the political elite in this country. And he didn't even conceive of it as a possibility that you just get out the ECHR and move on with your life. He couldn't understand it.
They're very much stuck in their own bubble. This is why, for instance, someone like Rory Stewart put his £50,000 bet or whatever on Kamala Harris, right? they talk amongst themselves about the topics of the day. They get all their news from Reuters, typically. There's very little actual investigative work. And then they sit there and they can't comprehend. This is why we talk about the disconnect between, say, the journalistic or an elite class and the regular person. This is why they also value polls kind of so dearly, because none of them actually know anyone. It's also why anyone who's interested in and studying something like elite theory, it's quite an alien way to look at the world. But if you go to or watch any of these conferences, for instance, where they speak, and I'm not talking just about world leaders here or something, I'm talking about elite intellectuals and people like David Betts and stuff like that, right? Like, regardless of whether or not you agree or disagree with Betts' analysis.
I'm shocked you didn't include Ed in your list of elite intellectuals.
You look at, well, it's the difference between an elite intellectual and an intellectual elite. That's what I'll say. But
very diplomatic, Mark.
Always. So my point is that they speak about things in a very different way and they view things in a very different way. And then they mingle with people who all think the same or in a similar vein, which is why it's an athlete. You know, there has been this post-war consensus really with the retraction of the British Empire that we are a kind of, aside from the Falklands, which was something of a departure, an outlier, you've got the American vassal military, right? The Americans are going to invade Iraq and we're going to join them. And so we're going to deploy some of our army in this very particular province and we'll kind of take that and do that, right? That's the only acceptable use of military force now. Everything else must be rendered impotent. You know, despite the fact that obviously many people have opposed our military interventions abroad, but again, none of them have really been driven by the British government. So the idea of us as a nation with agency has also been left the kind of elite consciousness. This is also why people are so excited, for instance, about, again, rightly or wrongly, Rupert Lowe and his new party, because he's the only one who seems to be putting forward a positive vision for the future of the country. So when I talk with Alex Masters, if you're familiar with him, quite a lot about this sort of thing. But, for instance, when we think about a reimagining of the state, most people and the elite class think of Tory austerity. Tory austerity, if you look into the numbers, if you dig into all the data, was a movement of money from frontline services to the NHS. That was it. If you look at the actual total government expenditure, it basically didn't change. It may even have gone up. And then you have, on the other side of that, the total reimagining by the dissident class, as represented by, say, Rupert Lowe, which is, we're going to come in, and when we say we're going to gut the state, that means a third of you are out of work. And if you get in our way, you'll be first on the block. That sort of thing. And the state will look completely different.
That's what I was thinking about that, Mark. I don't know, chaps. Lipton, it really looks very silly. So if you could just sort of sit up a little bit, that would be much appreciated. it just looks like a disembodied Malteser. Just up. Right. Okay, good. That's better. I think this is... chaps, have we watched the Rupert Lowe thing? Because meet the Rupert Lowe party political broadcast thing, whatever you want to call it. Because I was fascinated by this. All I thought to myself as I was watching it was, if you do that, what you're saying you're going to do, yes, you're right, there's going to be short-term pain, which will be amazing. I mean, it will be like nothing we've experienced in our lifetimes at all. People can't understand. But people who are, well, me and Paul are a bit older by quite a lot than Lipton or indeed Mark.
Speak for yourself. I've just had a rough life.
Yes,
actually, I don't know what you're talking about.
But the idea of things like going on holiday abroad in 1980, people romanticise that, or the 90s or the 80s. Do you understand how expensive things were? I mean, a video recorder in 1985 was £500. £500 in 1985.
Yeah, but Ed, to be fair, there was nothing worth recording, so you really didn't miss
come
it.
Come on, oh, there was Cilla, and there was Benny Hill.
She took up a Laura room on me tapes.
She did, and she took, and there was Tommy Cooper, and there was the Morgan & Wise show at Christmas. There was all kinds of stuff, little and large, loads of stuff worth recording. Anyway, my point is that people's standard of living was much lower. The cost of food in relation to income was higher, significantly higher. So people go on about, oh, I can't afford to buy a house. Now, yeah, you could afford to buy a house in 1985. Yes, you could. But food, that'd be pricey. So it would be a real hardship, an intense hardship that people aren't used to. I mean,
Ed, sorry to push back a little bit. There wasn't an awful lot worth buying to eat in those days.
No, I remember being in Safeway in 1984 and I discovered the concept of a kiwi fruit.
Yeah.
And my parents didn't know what it was, so we called
it a beard. Sorry, Ed, self-deprecatory humour here. I had an ex-girlfriend who patiently watched me trying to peel a kiwi fruit promptly took it off me, cut it in half and gave me a spoon.
Yeah. I'm imagining Ed a bit like those videos of... Africans encountering bottled water for the first time, like that. But he's just got a kiwi fruit. Like
we didn't know what it was. We didn't know what it was. I mean, you didn't get kumquats until the late 90s,
and then you got the medication for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then you had to go to the doctor. But there was no waiting list in them days. But and you never had sex with that girl again. But anyway, the point.
I love the way you have to explain it for your followers, Ed.
Well, he explained it for himself. He can't help himself.
Most of my followers have contracted sexually transmitted diseases from kumquats over their time. It's just true. Don't lick a kumquat, guys. Just leave it alone. You don't know where it's been. Do you
listen? My turn to speak?
Yeah, but
yes. So I've been in the UK for a few years now, and I am repulsed by the sight of welfare. I think it's time to get rid of universal credit. People need to work. The Brits are bums.
Like, and how much, Lipton? How much benefit are you on a week?
None.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Before coming here, I really admired the English people, but now that I'm here, I'm so upset that so many young people are on universal credit. That's why I like Jim Ratcliffe. He spoke the truth. Too many people are out of work. If you're young, you should go and work.
Lipton, sure. Did you know that Ed is on a welfare scam, even though he lives in Finland?
No. Yeah, I get universal credit. Yeah, I get child benefit
And he gets an EU grant for his reindeer in the back garden.
No, there's nothing more irritating than listening.
I just realised I just paid for a new insurance policy on my new car, Paul, and I didn't get... you're right, I didn't get reindeer insurance.
No. I Mark looks like he's getting bored.
What? No, he's just quite a grumpy man.
I cannot fathom the practicality of paying people to have children. When I was a toddler in Jamaica, like 10 or younger, I would listen to stories, and these stories were usually
Lipton. Ed pays women to be his girlfriend, so you're wasting your time explaining it.
Finnish ports, very
exactly. So I would usually listen to Jamaicans talk about people in the UK or the US who had children and they would get money. And I wondered why. Why would you pay people to have children? That's your business. It irritates me. We need to get rid of the welfare state completely.
That's another thing the Labour Party have U-turned on in their long list of U-turns, isn't it? Getting the two-child benefit cap thing.
They have removed it, yeah.
I thought they U-turned on it. They're not going to remove it. They can't. They're not.
Oh, they're not.
No, that's another one of their U-turns. Like, they've just U-turned literally before when I was reading the internet newspapers before I started this show. They've U-turned on the banning, not having elections in various counties and districts and so on. They've got rid of that. So the reform have won that case. So they can't hold to anything. I'd have a lot more respect if they just said, yeah, fuck it, we're not running the elections.
Yeah, but Ed, to be fair, it's not like the Prime Minister was a highly qualified barrister and could have foreseen that the legal case would be lost.
That's true. It's not like the Prime Minister was the one of the chief lawyers in the country. And therefore you'd expect him to have an amazing rumpole of the Bailey-like legal mind.
Sir Starmer is brilliant. I love Sir Starmer. I love Kemi. I love all of them because I'm going to live here.
Lipton, if you're going to use titles... Oh, also, Lipton, just to let you know, on the 5th of March, you're going to be in a film in Luton.
Sorry, Ed.
I'm going to be in Luton?
Yeah, we're paying your expenses. You're going to be in a film about Luton, which I'm going to make. All right.
Okay.
They've got the studded outfit ready for you, Lipton.
I'm just reading. I can see February 3rd. I can see 16th of February. Sir Ashley Fox spoke in the House of Commons, warning that Labour's proposal to scrap the two-child benefit cap would increase welfare spending. But it did pass the initial parliamentary stage.
No, they've definitely gone back on it. GB News was reporting it, yeah.
Oh, 3 hours ago.
Mm. Yeah, that's the thing that I didn't understand. Like what you were saying, Mark, earlier about the news cycle. Like, it's all so quick. What can you do? I mean, I remember the days when I'd watch the Channel 4 7 o'clock news, and then I'd watch the 9 o'clock news, and then maybe if I was feeling a bit kinky, I'd watch Newsnight. But you know, otherwise, you know, go to bed. I had school in the morning. Newsnight was 10:30. If you had to get up at 7 for school, 10:30, you know. And then no news. I mean, God, when Princess Diana died, I was so naive. Do you remember that when Princess Diana died, Mark, or were you too young?
A bit young for that.
No, it was a disgrace. Liverpool were due to play Newcastle on a Sunday afternoon, and they cancelled the game because some French chauffeur hit a bloody bollard. I'll never forgive them for that.
You know what pissed me off is both when Lockerbie happened, whatever year that was, and when the Berlin Wall fell, they cancelled BBC Children's Telly. I got up on a Saturday morning all ready to watch like Dog Tanyan and the Three Muskerhounds and the Wide Awake Club and whatever it was that I was watching.
You remember Jamie and his magic torch? Jamie! Magic torch!
Were you like on drugs at university watching that? In the same way that we used to watch things like the Teletubbies at university on drugs.
I love the Three Muskerhounds music as well. I just love theme tunes.
Well, that's like 1985, so you're born... Yeah, that makes sense. You're at university watching children's programmes. Because when my dad was at art school, they used to watch Rhubarb and Custard, which was a children's... But that was kind of aimed at people on drugs, really, wasn't it? I mean, it's quite psychedelic. Sort of wobbling and so forth. Richard Briers used to live down the road from me.
Oh, I used to. She was my first crush, Felicity Kendall.
Mm.
Oh, ding dong.
I mean, she was quite pretty, wasn't she? She
was Lipton, have you seen Felicity Kendall?
No, I have not.
Oh. She's not Anne Widdecombe standard, but she's good.
I've changed the search parameters to in the past hour. The two-child benefit cap is still coming off. They've U-turned on a few things, but it was local elections. They've U-turned on blocking local elections for May. But the child benefit cap seems to be sticking around.
Okay, we apologize, chaps. It is good to have someone as sage and serious and dry sense of humor
and unfunny as Mark Houghton.
No, he is quite funny. But that's the thing with these John Pienaar guy. Like, they don't hang around the same kind of places we do. They don't go to like the Wetherspoons in Hailsham. They don't meet the George in Hailsham. They don't meet the real people. You know, they don't go to the newsagent in Polegate.
Well, I meet real people.
Sorry,
I've been meeting real people. Even rich Jewish people and middle class people who are tired of immigrants.
Wow.
Even pastors, yes. Like our minister of religion was saying.
Do they call you the word or do you give them the pass?
Yes, our minister of religion was saying to me that in London, some of the immigrants are just sitting down doing nothing at all. They're just sitting.
Milling.
Yeah, exactly. Milling, yes.
With good posture, though.
That is. I don't know. I did a video on this years ago, and I'm not.
Yeah,
sure
I remember
what
it.
Yeah, but what is the variable that in these kinds of countries? I guess it must be that it's just that it's hot. That in these kinds of countries, it's acceptable to just sit and mill around.
Exactly. They're just like in Jamaica. Yeah. Even if there's a hurricane, people just come outside just to watch the hurricane. They're just so weird.
It's a group of men. Whereas in England, or Finland, let's say, if you go in the summer to by the beach in Oulu, there'll be groups of people, but there'll be both men and women intermixed. But for some reason, in these societies, it's just men, and they're not drinking either. They're just sitting there talking loudly in a kind of street parliament. And I don't think it's necessary. I think they should.
I think there should be a quota, and this quota should be imposed on all third world countries.
What are we doing? The wearing fedoras, like what is this idea? Well, Panama's. The wearing hat.
Someone in the chat said he would look funnier if he had a silly hat on. So I put the hat on.
Oh, okay, that's a good idea. Well, I'll put a silly hat on as well, see if I can find one. Yeah, and we could all. You have any silly hats, Lipton or Paul, that we can put on?
No, I have none whatsoever.
All right.
Does my snake count?
Yeah. You can put your snake around your neck, and I'll wear my silly hat. And Jesus,
just can wear bitten.
His silly hat. We can all. All right, now Paul, hurry up. I'm about to go halfway through. Lipton, don't interrupt me during the halfway through spiel. I'm giving you a due warning. Very good. No, that is what kind of snake is that?
Boa constrictor.
Yeah. Because even the ones that don't strangle, when they get quite upset, they can go quite hard. So there was a Basil the snake who was a python. You know what I mean, Paul? Who was?
When I laugh, his head goes like that.
My headmaster snake went hard when he got upset.
I'm sure it did.
That is my headmaster snake, which he called Basil, used to get hard if he got upset. That's very good. That's very good.
You can see why they call the scarf boa constrictors, though, can't you?
I'm not sure what the Latin or Greek origin of boa.
No, I mean in musicals, you plonker.
Oh, I see.
What's Latin got to do with the musical?
Well, I don't know what the origin is of the name boa constrictor.
Right, but given that it was called a boa constrictor, do you then understand why they call them boas when they used to wear them in musicals?
I suppose so. Yes, I suppose so. Let's not fall out over this. Okay, we're about halfway through. So to those of you who are new, hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss based science and just after there's increasing expansion from our woke joke universities. And with us today, we have various people. What is that? It's not very comfortable wearing this, I have to say. I can
oh
see
God, imagine.
No one's forcing you to wear the hat.
the Vikings conquered all these lands, and you've got Ed at the back of the longboat. Oh, it's a bit uncomfortable, this.
That is a bit. It is a little bit uncomfortable.
The sad thing is that was a hat made from a breastplate, of course.
All right, now where was I? This is my Fezzi. It's a Greek hat. Okay, so chaps, if you're new, yes, could you please subscribe? Could you subscribe on YouTube and could you subscribe on my Substack, which is johnnyharris.com, where I put all those base stuff I can't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, films I make. And if you like what I do, you can support me with the cost of a pint of beer a month. And I cannot emphasize enough, one of the most interesting books I've ever written has come out today, The Quaker Question. There we go, chaps. So this is truly incendiary stuff. This is going for it.
Is the main question, do you use water or milk?
No, it's an allusion to a book that was written in the 19th century about another group.
Awesome.
And I should emphasize as well that, of course, the Quaker Oats people have nothing whatsoever really to do with the Quakers.
It's your favorite bit of trivia, that.
Eh?
It's your favorite bit of trivia, that. Anytime anyone goes, oh, the Oats people, and you go, no!
But it's wrong. It's objectively wrong. They're wrong, and they just spread this idea. When I first talked on this show about my Quaker book and the way they control the world, all I got were these supposed jokes about, oh, the Oats.
Ed, I think you're completely correct, though. I don't think in any shape or form ever should humour have anything that isn't 100% accurate. That is the basis of good humour, as you found out.
Why are you not talking about my book?
Well, we'll come to that. I'm going to go to Mark next because he's next to me on the screen. Okay, next to me is Mark Houghton. So, and he has a YouTube channel called Not So Obvious. So go and subscribe over there. And he also does some other channel. What is it?
Well, I mean, I contribute on occasion once or twice a year to the Low Seasons. That's about it. I occasionally appear on The Academic Agent. And my channel at the moment, which is more active than it's been in a few years, I have a couple of roundtables on there. I'm talking principally to Morgoth's Review, but also to Millennial Woes and Nima Parvini, AA. About remigration, the UK murder rate, and something else, the most recent one, the limits of power. Why doesn't Trump just take Greenland? If anything of that nature is of interest to you, do find Not So Obvious, go there. Obviously, send hundreds of pounds in super thanks messages in the comment section, as per usual. You know, everyone's doing it, so you should too. There you go.
Okay, cheers. So, remember to do that, chaps. Okay, and then below we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. And so please subscribe to Lipton Matthews' channel, which is just called Lipton Matthews. And also please read Lipton's book that he hasn't published yet.
He's going to Boston African Delusions. That's the name of the book.
African Delusions.
Is it about the implant tourism trade? Yeah.
No, it's Busting African Delusions.
It's a misleading title, Lipton. You need to rethink that.
Also, it doesn't alliterate. It would benefit with something like Busting Bantu and then something begins with B.
Isn't the concept of an African delusion something of an oxymoron?
Oh, that's not nice.
Oh,
Lipton, I'm offended on your behalf.
Intelligence, institutions, and the parts to progress.
I'm also offended on Lipton. I often get offended on behalf of minorities and oppressed groups.
Oh, yes. Well, have you ever been to Africa? I have.
No, I have not.
I've been to the Canary Islands, which I feel should count.
I've been to Kenya, and I was doing...
Sorry, Mark, I thought you were like... It was a trivia question. You were from Tanzania or something originally, line you used.
I'm actually a roadie, you know, just suddenly put on a really thick roadie accent.
Have you ever been to Africa?
Have you ever been to Africa?
I watch Nollywood movies, and I can tell you this. They're really funny, but as I will explain to somebody a few days ago, my God, those people are stupid. They're really stupid.
But you're taking this from a sort of anthropological perspective, so it's fascinating stupidity to you.
Like, there's basically no justice system in that country. You can go anywhere and just call the police and say, police, lock up John Brown, and the police will show up and just lock him up.
That is the diametric opposite to the British police.
Then you have
they won't turn up at all, no matter how many times you ring them.
And witchcraft is the cause. It's always the cause. I feel sick, it's witchcraft. I can't get a job, all my enemies in the village. They have finally killed me.
Yeah, in the Congo, I hear they're quite into the old witchcraft. Anyway, finally, next to Lipton is Dr. Paul Taylor. And so please subscribe to his channel, Readers of the Lost Art, which takes a wry and cynical look at literature and that.
I've just done a video, Ed, on Jeffrey Epstein and Dracula.
Excellent. The idea being what?
The actual novel Dracula, if you go into it, it's quite fascinating. The Illuminati type, basically, you know, the idea how they caught Dracula was with filing system and typewriters. So there's one reading of the actual novel that it's all about technological change, and Dracula represented the old guard. So it's a more sympathetic appreciation of good old Count Dracula.
You know, he died of syphilis.
Everyone did, according to you.
but Bram Stoker did. Bram Stoker died.
Oh, yeah, that, actually, I'll give you that one, so to speak. That was true. I remember reading that, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Whereas Nietzsche definitely didn't.
No, he just died because he was cross. Okay, now we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has written the following poem at some point. There we go. In honour of today's show. It's something that's happened for years beyond people's very worst fears. Islamic grooming, today is still looming, but letter types cover their ears. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. That's excellent as usual. And if you would like to buy Mr. Quinn's book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, it is, of course, available on the old Amazon. And you should also subscribe to Marcus cleaning this camera lens there. I suppose he's turning his camera off. I don't know what he's doing. You should also subscribe to his channel. Okay, now, we have some questions that have been sent in. So before we move on to anything else, I will answer those. We will answer those. So the first question is from Chris Mack. And he says, Lipton, seems it was Tolui conquered Iran, Khorasan.
Yeah, I found the article I was looking for. I did.
Okay, so that's a reference to our meeting with Ali.
Yeah, we're talking about the Mongolian invasion.
Right, and the next question comes from Sensible Center, and he says, restore Britain at 60,000 members now. Joined yet? Nope, I don't live in England, so I see absolutely no reason whatsoever to join an English political party. Mark, have you joined yet?
I'm in the awkward position where... I may end up getting a day job, which prevents me from being allowed to be a member of a political party. So I'm holding off for now, but basically just waiting in the wings. And if that goes pants up, then no. Then yes, I will join it. Sorry.
Well, I am black, so I can do what I want.
True. So are you going to join Lipton?
Yes, I will go to Luton.
No, I know you're coming to Luton though, because I'm going to put you up in a terrible hotel, and then we'll just walk around Luton and have a right laugh. But are you going to join this political party?
What's the name of it again?
Restore. It's been quite big in the news over the last day. It's called Restore Britain, Lipton.
Probably. It all depends. If they offer me a seat, like the Open Party in Wales, then I will accept. But then I can't run. I have not been here long enough.
Good. And Paul?
No, it's too much like the Judean People Popular Front and all that.
That's what I thought. I was watching the video. I mean, I like what he did. I like that he's more based than reform. I like that he doesn't do things like sack people from the Lotus Eaters as candidates because they say things that then subsequently become party policy. I like various things about Rupert Lowe and what he's up to and that. But, I mean, for God's sake, like, we don't. Why on earth do we need... Reform is going to do well in the next election. Why on earth do we need to have a party standing?
I think you've just said why, Ed. He wants to wreck reform.
There's also two things. The first is that Farage has taken on a lot of Tory defectors. So, understandably, they are seen as a continuation now of the Conservative Party and unlikely to get anything that we want done. And secondly, the reality is we have to wait and see. It's only been live for 3 days. I am most curious if he can attract and retain talent. So this is the thing, which is encouraging to me about the whole spiel, is he said, I'm going to pull in all these people from different business sectors, competent experts in their own field, and they're the ones who are going to staff my party and who are going to staff the commons when I come to power, if that such a thing is going to be. So I want to see what talent he can attract and then how he can retain it. Because this is one of the great weaknesses of reform, which is Farage is the only person in reform that's there. The only other guy is obviously Zia Yusuf, who bought his way in and is there as long as he keeps funneling money into the thing. But every other contender, every other person who threatens Farage's ego has been obliterated. There is an interesting theory at the moment that he's brought Matt Goodwin on. So Matt Goodwin, and Robert Jenrick. The reason that he's brought those on is so they can fail. So that when they fail, he can say, look at them, they're so extreme, they failed, and when we're now going to push towards the centre. So we're going to realign towards the centre ground.
Well, Mark, wouldn't it be a very odd thing to do to give Matt Goodwin the eminently winnable seat if he actively wanted him to fail?
So that's the question, isn't it? Right. So it's like he can't lose from the interaction. Either they, I was thinking more of Robert Jenrick than Matt Goodwin, but I misspoke. But obviously, Matt Goodwin is just in a curious position where it's like if he wins, then he gets the seat. And if he loses, then he has an excuse to move towards the centre. So, and every day I have Richard Tice in my mind going, why do I care about beyond the next election cycle? I'll be dead when, you know, in 2050 or whatever. I don't care. So I go, it's the best we've got. I don't really care. Like, if they're just a continuation of the Uniparty, it doesn't matter who you vote for anyway, right? So I don't care. I'm just going to vote for my principle, which is probably going to be Restore, and we'll see where we go from there. Really.
Right. Could I make one quick point, though? It's all premised on the idea, though, that Restore could possibly take any votes other than from Reform or the Tories. And if they can only take votes from Reform and the Tories, then all you're doing is taking votes away from right of centre.
So one thing, the first is the red wall. There's the context of the previous election, right? So the context of the previous election is lowest turnout ever, because everyone, including a huge portion of the quote-unquote red wall, which is this big block that usually votes Labour, voted for Boris Johnson in 2020 under the mantra of get Brexit done. And when 2024 came around, or whenever the last election was, they said, no, we're not voting anymore. We're just not. And all the Tory voters said, no, we're not voting anymore. We're just not doing that. And so now we're in this strange space
Can I just say something? I wonder why our viewership is so low. It's because apparently X has crashed.
X has crashed, yeah. It's been up on and off all day. It's really annoying. But my point is that means there's like this is the last hurrah is this idea of sort of reform restore side of things. It's like, well, we're putting our eggs in a basket because the system is so corrupt and so broken that we're going to end up in a really horrific state, not just economically, but also culturally. We're already in a pretty rough place. So,
Mark, can I come back on this? Because
29 is a kind of last gasp election, really.
I've got a lot of sympathy because I generally, very rarely, do I bother voting because I just find it encourages them. But having said that, I do think you can fall into the danger of thinking it's a uni party and they're all the same and it can't get any worse. And then you experience the last 18 months.
It absolutely can get worse.
Exactly. The uni party can get worse. So in that sense, wouldn't you want, if you're right of centre, wouldn't you want to give right of centre the best possible chance?
I would, but Farage is not right of centre. He's left of centre. This is the issue, right, is that he has taken on the Tories, who are the backbone. He's taken on Zawahi, whatever, Hussein, or whatever his name is, and he's tacking to the centre and being very quiet whilst doing it. So the trouble is that if he's just a continuation of the Conservative Party, then there is no right of centre option, and that will have to.
That's a big assumption. That's a big assumption, though. He didn't take all the Tories. People keep trotting this out. He took a few Tories who were the most right wing in their party, and some of whom, not all of them, were brilliant, but some of whom spoke out against what was going on. They'll be accused of not having any experienced people if they don't take them anyway.
I don't care if they spoke out about it after they had already done the damage. Even people like Robert Jenrick was the immigration minister who was speaking out about it and yet did nothing to stop the Boris wave, which is also the continuing thing. So all of these people, in my mind at least, right, I could be completely insane, could be wrong, are tainted, right? They're damaged goods, and you need a fresh start, which is, again, why it's refreshing to see Restore. The other important thing to note is there are 3 years to go. 2 years ago, Reform were on 6%. Restore, according to latest polling, which came out yesterday, 10%, just by themselves because of this thing. The membership number is a bit misleading because, obviously, he launched Restore Britain as a movement that transitioned to a party. So they had 30, 40,000 members, I think, before the party announcement. So them saying 50, 60,000 now is a little misleading. But I'm seeing, and again, I'm in my echo chamber, so it could be completely wrong, but I just see people flocking to this and going, like, he's saying it's going to be really, really hard and I'm going to do the most difficult thing possible and we're all going to go through shit times. And then I see dozens, hundreds of young men going, okay, point me in the right direction, point me in this direction and throw me. So if he's able to weaponize that support, because again, this is something Farage doesn't do.
Mark, as a person that's lived in Finland for 21 years and is thus a little bit out of touch with stuff on the ground in England, how bad is it? Like, I'm trying to think. I'm, as you know, quite autistic and can only deal with things if I've experienced them myself, and I haven't experienced. Yeah, sure. We can agree on that. So, for example, something like getting a house in Finland, when I bought this house in 2010, what you do, right, is you don't even pay a deposit. There's no deposit. And they just trust you that you're telling them the truth about how much you earn. And then you buy a house. And on a 20-year mortgage.
Ed, can I ask a quick question?
But how bad is that in the UK? Like,
but these are all like, it's bad. How bad on a scale of 1 to 100 do you want? But someone said in the comments that I'm assuming that Farage is an honest broker. No, they're assuming that I'm assuming that. I never said for a second. Farage could be absolutely incompetent. My point, the overarching point is, on the right now, with Restore, what you threaten to have is the exact mirror image of what always happens on the left. The Judean People's Popular Front takes over from the Popular Front of Judea. It's ideological purity at the expense of everything.
I mean, I don't know. I see it much more as Rupert is the only party offering the sensible position that is the standard position of basically every Englishman in England, pretty much, give or take like 20 to 30%, of which 15% is radical. So that's kind of where I see it. So I'm like, that's the centrist position. Rupert is the centrist position, maybe slightly to the right. And that's basically as far as I go with that. And everyone else has got to be judged against the barometer of that sense.
What he's saying he's going to do, there would be a mutant uprising. There would be an uprising of mutants, and there would be an uprising of mutant sympathizers within the civil service.
So you've either got to, the first thing to do is he's got past the media issue. The media issue is, we're going to shame and defame you, and it's the same with the insult. So it's like the word racist, for instance, gets thrown around, and that's obviously becoming completely meaningless. So if he's not after their approval, then he can't be touched on the defamation front. But the issue he has to deal with is the entrenched deep state, right? As you said, Ed, it's the people who, I saw a clip the other day of a bunch of a Romanian family came over, and they were on job seekers allowance, and they were sad they couldn't get a council house. So an African woman went to her Indian boss and said, this family is here. And the Indian boss said, we found you a house and we'll have you in next week because you're on job seeker's allowance. That's enough, right, to get you into a house. Now, obviously, on a deep and personal level, that's an affront on, like, so many levels. But you're going to have to deal with, like, the noisy revolt of all those people, right, going on strike or something. And then you're going to have to deal with the deeper issue, which is that you task a minister, a senior civil servant minister, to do something. And he says, of course, that can be achieved, minister, in 8 to 10 years after we go through this whole series of processes that will conveniently take the course of 5 years, by which point we'll have found a way to oust you, right? Well, so that there won't be anything achievable done. This is how you end up where a 20-mile stretch of road ends up costing £150 billion and takes 30 years to construct in this country. So what you end up with, what you need to be able to deal with is that. Which is why, again, we can't. It's all speculative at this point until I see the talent pool for Restore Britain.
Yeah, but even if they were the most efficient party, the most spontaneously, organically growing party in the history of humankind, they are not going to set up a working, properly efficient party in the next 3 years that will stand an election with any chance of winning. Reform could.
Then you can call me. You can call me a cope, but a reform is more of the same, and I'm just not willing to accept it.
No, absolutely fine, but you're still not. You don't seem to be answering the question about the mirror image of the ideological purity of the left. It's just the exact opposite.
I mean, I don't see them as particularly ideologically Puritan. Their only point is Britain right. for the British.
The ideological purity comes from choosing a party that might be ideologically tick all the boxes, but has got a snowball's chance in hell of ever getting near power. That is what the left have done for 60, 70 years. If the right wants to get into power, you don't do that.
So you see them as kind of like the right-wing equivalent of the Greens, right? Sort of where you see them?
No, I'm not. I'm saying something different. Again, I'm saying I don't even know fully what they stand for. I'm saying look at it from just a purely pragmatic point of view. How are they going to be in a position within 3 years to form, to have even a chance at getting power?
Well, again, the situation is so bad.
In the '70s, you had the National Front, and the National Front they never won a seat, but they were Britain's third biggest political party in terms of numbers, and you'd have people that would break away from them. The new National Front,
yeah,
the National.
The only thing I will say is one: Rupert hasn't broken away from Reform. Reform threw him out, and he's considered different. And he was a sitting MP, which is slightly different to anyone else setting up a political party. And then secondly, I will say that really Reform, again, I will say Reform isn't set up as a proper political party. It was a limited company until very recently, and only recently adjusted itself. And even then, there's no committee or anything like that. There's no accountability structures with it. From an organizational standpoint, you would say Reform isn't anything like Labour or the Tories, and they've got a snowball's chance in hell then of being effective there. But at the moment, they're the default position for anyone who doesn't want to vote uniparty. But they seem to be absorbing parts of it and going, moving in that direction. So I would say I will give it 2 years to see where they're sort of at, and then you can evaluate 12 months out.
Even the Nazis, when they started to become significant, were drawing people over from the Christian Democrats or whatever, weren't they?
You haven't addressed the point, though. Whether you like it or not, there's the blob of the civil service, there's the whole machinery of government. Sure. The idea that any political party, no matter how much you want them, to be able to change everything overnight. I'm speaking from a place where I actually agree with the sentiment.
In practical terms. I'm trying to understand you here as well. Yeah.
Right. In practical terms, bad as they may be, and I'm not saying they're not, for the thickos in the chat, what I'm saying is Reform are the only chance within a first-past-the-post political system with a 3-year timescale to achieve 1/100th of what most of the people in the chat probably want.
Okay, so I'll just say a final, because I think we're just going to go back and forth on this otherwise. I would say if the general election was... You can speak as well, obviously. I will say,
I'm the chairman here. You can speak on it, obviously.
If the general election were held next week, I would agree with you. But I think 3 years is a very long time in politics, and I think that you underestimate what can be achieved in that time.
But again, Mark, you're not addressing the issue.
I'm trying to address your point.
Let me explain why you're not then. 3 years is a huge time in politics in terms of discussion and in terms of debate. 3 years in terms of building the machinery, the practical elements of politics, is no time at all. They're two separate questions. You could make brilliant ideological progress in three years, but you're not going to suddenly imagine a government.
I guess we just disagree then that that's achievable.
On my side of the argument is the history of Western democracy, where there's never been an example of anyone other than perhaps Ed's example of the Nazis, who've done it in quick order.
Good. So there we go. We have an example. No, we haven't agreed. We have an example of who to imitate.
My turn.
What did the Nazis do? And
my turn.
Lipton.
The men who led the Nazi movement had really high IQs.
Well, my only counter argument to you, Paul, is that Reform haven't done that either. They've only existed for a couple of years and they don't seem to have any machinery either.
Paul's right. Let's focus on what we know. Who are the people that managed to do this and do it quickly? The Nazis. So they are the people that we have to model. They are the people that have to be modeled. Are you watching Hope Not Hate? They are the people that have done it. So what did they do? Well, first of all, they had the Reichstag fire and they used it as an excuse to suspend all civil rights. That was the first thing they did. So this idea that you can go around protesting or expressing your opinion, fuck that. That's out. That's finished. That's over. Okay, we get a mentally ill Dutch person to set fire to the House of Commons, and then we suspend all rights. So that's what has to be done.
Well, we're not in terms of suspending rights. We're not far off going down the whole road anyway.
True, we've done that since 1997. We've done that loads. So it's just stepping. It's a difference of kind rather than a fundamental difference. Just say, if you're left wing and you protest against what we're doing, you'll be shot on sight. So that's. That seems to me to be the first thing Rupert has to do, and I'm sure he will. Sort it. That's it. That's what I said with my commentary I did on the video. This is a revolution. You'd need complete suspension of all civil liberties to do this, because otherwise you just get a mutants protesting and lying on the ground in front of buses and gluing themselves to pavements and God knows what. So the rule would have to be, if you mess around, you're shot.
Well, you don't need to go that far. It just needs to be exactly what happened with essentially Southport, right? You prove that you can mobilize courts and you can arrest people just as much as you like for various reasons connected to protest that isn't an arrest for protest. I feel like that's kind of ancillary to your idea of the mutant uprising is interesting. But it's like Parliament itself is sovereign in a way in which it isn't in other countries, and you can just do what you want and no one can stop you if you want to do it. And I don't know, I'm losing my train of thought with this. It's not sovereign though, is it?
Because Parliament has outsourced all kinds of things that it used to be sovereign over to quangos and made up courts and
you abolish all of those, right? You're the Parliament, technically on paper, Parliament is still sovereign over these things. Right? If the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, needs to go tomorrow, they can abolish it, but they don't, which is obviously the reason.
So what you need, going back to John Pienaar, is just to do things that John Pienaar would regard as unbelievable, like saying to the French, we are going to deport these people back to France. Oh, we don't want you to. Well, we're doing it anyway. What are you going to do? Are you going to stand up to us successfully like you stood up to the Germans in the war? So what are you going to do? We're doing it. Might is right. That's what we're doing.
But Ed, it wouldn't. What's always puzzled me about the whole French situation is, apart from grandstanding, I'm pretty sure the French rely upon us massively for connections with the Americans and for intelligence.
Yeah.
Any government with any cojones in the UK just has to say, we will stop cooperating with you at any level until you stop those bloody dinghies.
You can't, and even if you could, won't speak English. And so you need us to literally need us to communicate with the Americans, because you can't. So, because let's face it, no one French speaks English.
Did you hear that story in when, you know, they celebrated D-Day and our paratroopers flew into French fields? They actually, this is, as far as I know, I read it in one of the newspapers. They set up a table, the French customs, and made the paratroopers show their passports.
That's the kind of bureaucratic thing.
I know, it just, I couldn't think of a better example of French bureaucracy and lack of gratitude.
Yeah. Well, no, to be fair, that bloke I interviewed on the channel and it was taken down, that talks about that thing we're not allowed to talk about on this channel. What was his name, that chap? René Camus or something?
Oh, him.
Right.
Yeah, he spoke English. He spoke English. I think he's one of the few French people I've ever had a conversation with in English, rather than French. But yeah, he spoke English. But otherwise, they do speak it, but they don't want to speak it in public, like my correspondent Alain de Benoit. is like, yes, Ed, you could interview me, but in French. And my French is awful, so that would be one of these translators. It's very hard work doing continuous translation. You know, they have to have rest periods and things. So it's a bit of a shame. But yeah, I think that this is what we need, Mark. Going back to your point, you just need someone to cut the Gordian knot, as it were, and just say. And most
it remains to be seen if he can assemble the pieces of the sword, basically. But I have no confidence in it as of today. Right, it's a thing which I would like to, and it's a low investment from me to put in 20 quid and become a member of it to show kind of nominal support, which is basically a virtue signal. But I'm looking out over the next months and years what talent he can attract. And, you know, can he back up the claims that he's going to put together a team? Because, again, if you look at what caused Trump to win in America in 2016, he had all these talented people around him, and he attracted them and he promoted them, and there was kind of a route for those people to benefit from being part of his government. And by benefit, I mean, you know, they like them from a narcissistic point of view. They get a big policy platform, they get to alter things, etc. And he kept those people close, and he had a kind of inner circle, and that was people knew about that. We don't talk about Bannon, obviously, at this point with all the stuff that's come out with him and the Epstein allegations recently. But my point being, if Farage doesn't have any of that, you can't name a single sort of person on his sort of policy team that is of particular interest like that. And but Reform want Restore want to do it. So I will wait and see with bated breath. But at the moment,
so Mark, direct question: what happens if they Restore knock it out the park, and in 3 years' time there's a general election and they take half of Reform's vote? What do you think the overall result would then be?
Right. So the situation for 2029, as it currently stands, you either end up with a hung parliament and what's left of Reform is forced to coalition with Restore, or I think is more likely, if everything went right for Restore, is they would pick up 20 million Red Wall voters who did not vote in the last election and win a landslide, and that's what it would be.
But the first option cannot happen, because in a first past the post system, if they took half of Reform's vote, you are going, whoever is one of the other parties will win the seat. That's just how first past the post politics works.
Sure, we're talking about a total wipeout situation. Labour and the
But I'm saying if Reform, I'm bigging up Restore. Let's say
if they took half of Reform's vote and it was there, then it's a three-way system. You've got the Greens on 15%.
It's not PR, Mark. It's not PR. In a first past the post constituency-based system.
Yeah.
Labour or the Greens or whoever would be the beneficiary of the vote being split would romp home, and neither Reform nor Restore would hardly have a seat in Parliament. That's how it works. Yeah, it's not that I want it to work that way. Am I making it up?
In that Monty Python sketch where there's the silly party and the sensible party, and then there's the breakaway very silly party that may split the silly vote.
I just think it's much more likely that you would end up in a situation with a Reform government and a Restore opposition, right? Because I think that the landslide is going to be that intense. Like, that's what I think. But that's just me.
I don't think parliamentary politics works that way. It just
you're just fine, but I don't think the Tories or Labour will exist after 2029 at all in any capacity, even as a functionary system or with like 10
MPs. Yeah, Ed is quite popular, so I don't see why Ed can't join a party and become the next PM.
Well, I was the secretary of Wimbledon Young Conservatives in 1998.
No, that's the past. We want you to be the PM in 2030.
Oh, well, I was ward chairman of my local Conservative ward committee in 1999.
No, I want to be the minister of deportation.
I was on the executive committee of Aberdeen University Conservative Association.
Okay, I want to be the minister of deportation.
In 2003. I know. I would love to be the minister of deportation.
No, me.
Oh, you?
Yes.
No, I should be like the Secretary of State for deportations, and you should be the junior minister in charge of keeping fit Eastern European birds in the country.
Eastern European birds.
If fit Eastern European birds would be allowed to stay, right? And that would be your job. That would be government policy. Because it's very bad for a society to have too many men. Much better to have too many women. You have too many women, you have competitive. Purity signaling among the women. You have like Victorian England. You want excess women. That's what you want. So you would be in charge of going through Eastern European birds and making sure they weren't like too crazy. Like the really crazy ones would be deported. And the ones that had like tattoos or whatever. And then the non-crazy ones that didn't have tattoos. That would be your job, Lipson.
Well, I must say this, Ed. I don't second your opinion about the Nazis, what you just said, that the new party should follow the Nazi model. Because that can be construed as me supporting the Nazis, and I plan to stay here.
We're not supporting the Nazi chaps. We're just saying, realpolitik-wise, what is it that gets you actually running Germany? And the answer is, you know, they did take power, albeit in a quite violent and unpleasant way, but they're Germans. They did. I was reminded today, I was sent an email that I'm speaking at a conference in Germany in April, and I was asked, will you book your tickets yet? And I thought, well, A, normally the conference does that for me, and B, it's well over 2 months until the conference. So that's very efficient. Well over 2 months before the conference, you expect me to have paid my ticket. Like normally I would, about a month in advance, buy a ticket, but apparently 2.5 months. That's how efficient the Germans are. So, we should imitate them. What Minister of State would you be in my government, Paul?
I'm good with basements, so I'd quite like to be in charge of the Justice Ministry.
Excellent. And Mark?
I mean, obviously the Lord Protector of the Realm. That's me.
No, because
I've got that.
If I'm Prime Minister, right, then that would put you above me. That would be...
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'm after, Ed.
Okay, that's concerning. What was that 1970s series, The Guardians? And it was set in it's on YouTube, and it was set in the 80s, and in it, Britain is taken over by a fascist regime. And there's this guy, there's the Prime Minister, and there's this guy that's above him, that's basically the Lord Protector, that's basically head of the military. And so the Guardians, look it up, it's very interesting, the Guardians.
Oh.
1970s it was made, I think early 70s, I think it was broadcast early 80s, and it was broadcast in the 70s, but it was set in the early 80s. And the idea was that Britain had become this fascist dictatorship, and then there were these people fighting against it and stuff like this.
Ed, sorry, Lipton, but someone in the comments said, could they be Black Rod? But I think you could, Lipton.
What? Paul, guess what happened, Paul? You can't tell anybody, but I am planning to sneak my way into the US. Let me tell you how I'm going to do it. This group, this research organization in the US, gave me an online fellowship, and then I applied for another one, so I'm trying to sneak my way into the US. If I get the second one, I can get visa sponsorship, but don't tell anybody.
All right, I won't, promise.
Yeah, and also, because Twitter's down, there's only about 800 people watching. So yeah. Which is quite good, because that means we're back on, you know, we would have 1,800. We'd have 1,800 if Twitter wasn't fucking around.
It's fine, because obviously the star power of me guesting on your show will draw them in like droves.
It must have been, because if Twitter's down, then it would be more than half of the viewers that would be on Twitter. So I wondered what was occurring. Okay, I've any more questions? Anything I haven't looked at? Oh yeah, one thing I do think
somebody asked a question, Ed. They paid you money and they asked a question about Felicity Kendall. How dare you not read that one out?
I'll find it. Hang on. Please remind Paul that when he's talking about Felicity Kendall, he's talking about the woman I love. So we have a question there from Tom Good.
Are you old enough to remember Felicity Kendall did a very short-lived series called The Mistress or Mistress, she wore a pink dressing gown, a bit fluffier than the one you're wearing, and she was even more fetching than in The Good Life. Getting all excited, you say.
I only remember seeing her in The Good Life and in some stupid series with Pam Ferris called Rosemary and Thyme or some bollocks in the early 90s when they both happened to have surnames of different herbs and they were detective and they were like private detectives or solved mysteries or some bollocks. It was crap. But
I always thought, what was his name? Tom, purported husband in The Good Life. He never deserved her. I think me and what's his name could agree on that.
Well, it's quite obvious that that Jerry fancied her, and there was the Christmas special where they almost snogged, and then Tom fancied Margot.
But I quite fancied Margot, but only as a metaphorical bit of rough, which is ironic given how posh she was.
It is ironic. Yeah, a friend of mine,
I'd have married Felicity, and I'd had Margot as a mistress.
Right. So marry shag. What is it? What's the thing? Jess Gill introduced me to this concept. It's some game. Marry, shag, something or other. Something
kill.
Marry, shag. Jess Gill. Yeah, just Gill.
Kill.
No, kill.
Kill, marry, shag. Is that what it is? Yeah.
No, Gill. Yeah, you have to have a fish involved, Ed.
There's a lot of, because there's Jess Gill and there's Charlotte Gill. There's many Gill people on the kind of base right of women. They're very fishy.
Women, base?
Well, because, as I said, Jess Gill, Charlotte Gill, Nicola Sturgeon.
God, someone just said in the comments, you do have some deviance in your chat, Ed. They said Felicity Kendall was average looking.
Oh, no, that's just insane. Average looking would be, well, I'm not going to name any of them because that would be upsetting for them.
Well, I think that particular person's in gate, you know, going out with his mother, because what a stupid thing to say. God.
I don't know. What?
The only way I know Felicity Kendall is a joke from Red Dwarf, where they talk about going past a moon which was shaped like her bottom and therefore they circled it multiple times.
She was like a shy-looking Sydney Sweeney, wasn't she, of her time?
Yeah, if you see Sydney Sweeney without any slap, she's not very pretty at all.
Well, Felicity was, without any slap.
Felicity without any slap was pretty, but this Sydney Sweeney bird, slapless, not pretty at all. She was like that scene in this film I was watching last night with Demi Moore about this bird that like becomes a younger self via some medical procedure, and then there's this actress at the beginning that becomes prettier throughout. I can't remember what the film's called. We digress. Well, we're about the end, really. We've got about a minute. So would anybody like to say anything interesting about Felicity Kendall before we wrap up?
I'm really, people are talking in the chat, and I really am having fond memories of Margot now as well. I'm confused.
Well, there was something kind of wholesomely posh about her face.
You just wanted to be told off by her, didn't you?
Yes. And there was. Did you see that thing? What was it called? Two for tea in the mid 90s. Where these grandparents? It was Penny and it was William Andrew Gaunt, and they end up adopting their grandchildren. What was it called? You don't remember that? It was very good. It had an actress in it called. No, not Honeysuckle Weeks. That's somebody else. Anna Gosling, that was it. And I always thought that was a nice surname. Gosling. Gosling. Doesn't that sound nice? Anna Gosling. Gosling. Sounds a bit rude. Sounds a bit rude.
It's only because it's so close to Gosling.
Gosling, yeah. I bet when she was at university, after which she'd stopped acting, people would talk about Anna Gosling. And they're like, well, did she get it? Like, yeah, she did. Anyway, if you're watching Anna Gosling, cheers to you. Sorry, Gosling. I hear you run an antique shop these days. Okay, well, it's been a pleasure, chaps, and all of you people watching on YouTube like in the old days. And we will see you all next week, and tally-ho, and goodbye.
Goodbye.